No word was changed more by the coming of Jesus Christ than the word humble. Before Jesus came, man looked down on the word humble with disdain. The word humble, or humility, was a cringing word. To be humble before Jesus came was to be a coward. It was a shameful word. Nobody claimed it for himself. Nobody would ever dare say, I'm humble. But if you wanted to really, really be critical and to talk in disdain about somebody, he would say he's an humble man. Like we would say he's a dirty coward. That's the kind of word that humility was and humble was before Jesus came. It was used as an insult. In fact, probably it was most disgraceful of all the words in the vocabulary. Then Jesus came and made it the loftiest of all the words. To call a man humble is to praise him. And I doubt very seriously if you could honor a man or compliment a man or brag on a man any more totally than to say he's humble. Probably there is no word that you could use in the English language that would more exalt a man and more honor a man than to say that he's humble. Now, it's amazing. I'm talking about just the honest, simple history tells us that, and by the way, you can tell what a society is by what words mean to them. You'll find nothing that will perhaps measure the depreciation of our society any more than the changing of the meaning of words. There was a day when bread meant something made of wheat and put in a loaf. There was a day when cool meant not hot, and neat meant that it was not messed up. It's pitiful the way we've let the modern hippie crowd destroy the most beautiful language on the face of the earth. And we've let it happen because we sit and watch them talk all the time on the television and listen to them on the radio, that we ourselves have absolutely limited vocabularies. Most of us are half illiterate. We don't know any words. We don't know any way to describe our feelings at all. Our newspapers are written to 8th grade level of education, and now some people are saying down to the 6th grade level of education. And because we have let the profaners of our vocabulary and of our English language destroy the language. That's one reason why I rebel. I don't like to hear somebody call females guys. Hey, you guys, what you doing? Now, guys are the ones that have the beards, the ones that grow the beard. The male is a guy. I'll give you a little vocabulary lesson tonight. The male is the guy. Well, that's just the way I say it. Well, then quit saying it and use a word you mean. Use the right word. Let's don't destroy. You know, a nation's language a nation's language is more sacred than a nation's flag. A nation's language is more sacred than a nation's anthem. A nation's language is more sacred than a nation's pledge of allegiance. I'd rather you rip a flag than rip the language. I'd rather you profane the national anthem than to profane the language. And I'm not going to go into that much, but I'd like to someday. I'd like to start a crusade to recapture the English language again. If you ever want to see the depreciation of our society, you read some books that were written 75 years ago. I read old books every week of my life, and I live in old books, especially one of them. But that's one reason why it just burns the fire out of me when these little pinochle theologians want to change the Bible to put it in the vernacular language so men can understand it. Why don't we make men rise to meet the vocabulary of the Bible? There's nothing more beautiful than the English, the old English language that God has chosen with which to reveal His Word to man. And we've profaned it, and I don't like all these pictures of hippies on the front of it and so forth, and it's sickening. And the whole idea is we're trying to even bring God's eternal word down the level of profane vocabulary and limited vocabulary of illiterate people. Yeah, well, you're an educational snob. Well, if that's an educational snob, won't you join me? We need some people that love the English language again. Learn some words. Find some new words. One reason we're so limited in our vocabulary, we don't hang around anybody that has a vocabulary. You read like you ought to read, you'll learn some words. You know how to express yourself. Well, I just never did like, I never could write very well. Never could express myself on paper. You don't read much then. You read a lot. You'll hang around good words and good phrases and so forth. And that is not one ounce of snobbery in me at all. Not one ounce at all. I believe in old-fashioned, corn-fed, simple people. But there was a day when simple people knew something about the vocabulary. And but this word humble, or the word humility, changed totally upon the coming of our Savior. Now, how did this come about? From a word almost immediately. From a word that was a word of insult and disgrace. From a word that was almost the most hateful thing you could call somebody. He's humble, like he's a dirty yellow coward. To a word that's one of the most exalted words in all of the English language. Now, what happened? I want to give you two things. One is, Jesus came and taught us that restraint is more powerful than force. Don't leave me on that. Jesus came and taught that restraint is more powerful than force. It's harder to stop a car that's moving than to push a car that's standing still. It takes more power to restrain. Oh, this day of the macho man, the macho man. The truth is, the macho man's letting women take over society. He's so busy lifting weights, he hasn't got time to learn how to lead anything. And the macho man, I'll do my own thing. Oh, you little peanut head. You don't know what to do. You haven't got a thing. And honest truth is, exerting your force is not a sign of your strength. Restraining your force, Buster, is a sign of your strength. That's what Jesus came to do. Back in the Old Testament days, a guy that could exhibit his strength, he was the guy that was the macho man. And Jesus came and said, it takes more power to restrain than it does to exert. He taught us that the great conqueror is he, not who has his strength exhibited, but his strength restrained. He taught us that humility took the most power of all. He emphasized what the proverb said when it says, greater is he that conquers his own spirit than he that conquers a city. Somehow they got the idea, boy, if I can lick you, I'm a macho man. I'm a macho man. Yeah, you're macho stupid. You're macho ignorant. And you're macho feminine, too. I'll tell you, boy, I am the boss. Well, why don't you come out from the bed and tell your wife that? You wait till your passions are stirred. You wait till your passions are stirred and the fulfillment's available. You wait till you're tempted to do wrong and you want to do wrong and something on the inside of you says do wrong. And you wait till the temptress is there, the tempter is there. And you wait till something on the inside of you says yield and something on the outside says come to me. And you wait till you stand up and you stop the tide and stem the flow that is plunging towards you and you hold up and you stop the passion. You guys think you're a man because you can drink and take it. You're not a man. Do you learn how to not take it? That's the way you're a man. You're not a man. Do you have the bottle passed to you and you say, I won't do it? You're not a man until you say, well, I'm a macho man. I appeal to the women. I've had women. No, you're not a macho man for that. You're a macho man when you are tempted and the floods of passion come at your soul. And you say, I want to, and it says, do it. And you say, I won't do it. It's wrong. I won't do it. That's what real humility is all about. And that's what strength is all about. But the idea in our high schools and colleges that the macho man's the one that can drink the most. No, the macho man's the one that can restrain himself the most. But the idea of the macho man is the one that can A strong man is the one that can take the dope and have the women. No, sir, the strong man is the one who feels the same passions of the weak man. I'm not talking about some little homosexual guy has no passions anyway. I'm not talking about some eunuch. I'm talking about a real red-blooded, barrel-chested, muscle-bound man who has passions and appetites. And somebody comes up and says, let's have fun together. And he stops the tide of temptation and stops the tide of passion and says, that is wrong to do. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what strength is all about. Jesus came to tell us the humble man stronger than the proud man. He came to tell us the quiet man stronger than the loud man. He came to tell us the sober man stronger than the drunk man. He came to tell us the pure man stronger than the sensuous man. He came to tell us that the honest man is stronger than the dishonest man. He came to say that power is when you conquer yourself. Power is not when you conquer somebody else. Power is when you conquer yourself. You think you are a man and have strength. You wait till you're right. And you know you're right. And you have power to fight. But you don't. Then you know what manhood's all about. Oh, get in, this is the last thing I do. Peanut head. Sissy. Weakling. You wait till you're right. And you know you're right. And you have the power within you to fight. And all of a sudden, the passion of revenge fills your soul. And the passion of retaliation grips your soul. And all of a sudden, you stop and say, hold it, hold it, that isn't right. And all of a sudden, you say to your own self, I'll conquer you. You, listen, a passion, you won't conquer me. Appetite, you won't conquer me. Oh, God, give us some old-fashioned men again in America who can control themselves. Not men that can just control some company somewhere. Not men that can just control the line of scrimmage somewhere. Not men that can just control an army somewhere. But men who say their own passions, you'll not lead me. Their own appetites, you'll not control me. And you hold up and resist the tide and the flowing of passion. That's what strength is all about. You wait till you're the Savior of the world. Never sinned once. Never an evil mind went through or thought went through your mind. Never an unholy motive came to your soul. Your hands never touched a thing wrong to touch. Your feet never trod a path wrong to tread. Your ears never heard something wrong to hear. Your tongue never spoke anything wrong to speak. And you're the perfect Son of God who never sinned or thought of sinning. And all of a sudden, you are wrongly accused by the motley crowd for whom you came to live and die. And there they put you. Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. It was not the angry mob that put our Savior on the cross. It was love that put our Savior on the cross. Remember years ago, and I haven't told this here in years. I tell it around the country a lot. We had a fellow in East Texas Baptist College where I went to college. Came to college. His wife had 6 kids, and he just got saved a few months before he got called to preach. His call to preach was still warm when he got to college. His vocabulary was as wicked as the devil. I mean, he had to almost not say anything for 6 months after he got saved. He had nothing to say. He came to college. It wasn't long till First Baptist Church of Redwater, Texas, a little church of 100 people or so, called this old rugged farm guy been in the oil fields of East Texas to be their pastor. And one Sunday morning, he was preaching. And he's preaching on the cross. And his theology was all mixed up. He said the devil crucified Jesus, but his heart was right. And he said, the devil crucified Jesus. He's talking about the cross. And he said, you know what he did? He said, the devil put a crown of thorns on the brow of my Savior. And the devil took took a whip with a cat of nine tails and beat him across the back till you couldn't even tell he was a human. You know what the devil did? He put nails in his hands and his feet. You know what the devil did? He crucified him. He said, you know what I think about the devil? of a sudden, he forgot his new vocabulary and reverted to the old one. He proceeded for 5 or 10 minutes to cuss the devil out with every dirty word there is known to mankind. He called the devil a dirty son of a blank, blankety blank, son of a blank. He just proceeded to take a... He cussed like a sailor. And he proceeded to tear the devil apart. And the people sat there in stunned disbelief as they heard the most filthy language that could come out of a man's mouth. And finally, after about 10 minutes, it dawned on him what he had done. Oh, he bowed his head and did like that. And he couldn't even say, "I'm sorry." He began to cry. He folded his Bible and walked outside and got in his car and put his head on the steering wheel. And his wife went with him, and they sat there and cried and cried and cried. And nobody in the congregation could say a word. All the words had been said. And he went to the congregation, and finally the deacon chairman got up, and he stood down at the front here, small church, and he said, "Folks," he said, "I heard what you said." He said, "I never in my life have ever heard as much filth come out of the mouth of one man as came out of our pastor this morning." "Woo!" he said, "that's the most elaborate display of dirty words I've ever heard in my life." But he said, I got one idea this morning. I got the idea our preacher can't think much of the devil." And he said, "As far as I'm concerned, I'm glad we have a preacher that hates the devil." Now, he said, "Folks, all of us know that our preacher was a wicked man before he got saved. We knew that before we called him. And this morning he just got carried away, and I think we ought to just call him back and tell him we love him and tell him we're glad he hates the devil, but we should use a little different kind of language next time. And let's just give him a raise in pay to show him we love him." Now, I think there are better ways, you young preachers, to get raises in pay than that. They call the preacher back in, and they gave him a raise in pay, and he pastored that church for several years after that. If I thought that'd work, I'd say some things I've been wanting to say for a long, long time. As Jim Vineyard says, "I don't cuss, but if you'll write some dirty words on a piece of paper, I'll sign them after the service is over." But I'm talking about the devil. And by the way, I've got more respect for a preacher that'll cuss the devil than one that'll ask him to pray on a platform in a revival campaign. Jesus, this fellow thought that the devil had Jesus on the cross, but the hands of wicked men did nail him to the cross, and you wait until your perfection being accused by imperfection, your strength being accused by total weakness, and your God being falsely accused by man, and they mock you and laugh at you and spit on you. You have the power in your hand to call 12 legions of angels. He could have called 10,000 angels, but he didn't. Why? Because he stopped the tide. I think he had a desire to, but he stopped the tide. He conquered his own self. He conquered his own spirit. He came to die. He knew he came to die. And he could have called the whirlwind to come and the tornado to come. And the hurricane to come from the sea. He could have caused the lightning to fill the sky and the storm to come. He could have brought angels down. He could have caused the earth to open the mighty quake and destroy all of them. But he didn't. He restrained himself. And that's what strength is. Strength is when you conquer yourself. Strength is when you conquer your own appetites. You wait till you could destroy someone trying to destroy you, but restrain. And you'll know what strength is. You wait till the crowd is doing it, and you're alone. Nobody's going to know in your crowd that you're doing it. And you're alone. You're away from home in the Navy. In the barracks, they pass the liquor around. You're the only one that doesn't drink. And inside, something says, "Do it." And they say, "Do it." You wait till you stop the tide of temptation. And you wait till you restrain yourself and you say, "No, sir, I don't drink." Then you'll know what real manhood is. It was a day when America had people who knew what it was to restrain themselves. Now it's do your own thing, do your own thing, do your own thing. Do what feels good. No, sir. Do what you know is good to do. Jesus came to change the meaning of humility. He came to make teach us that restraint is more powerful than force. He came to teach us what strength is. You wait till someone sneaks behind your back and hits you on the cheek. And you turn your other cheek and say, here's the other one. Then you'll know what restraint is. Especially if you have the power to knock his block off. If you have the strength to whip somebody and you do not choose to do so, it takes more strength to resist than it does to display your power. Jesus came to show us that restraint is more powerful than force. You wait till you find Saul sound asleep, as David did. You wait till somebody like Saul has threatened to kill you, has thrown a javelin at you, trying to take your life and giving his whole life to plotting to kill you. I mean to destroy him physically. Kill him! You wait till he chases you and you run like a fugitive from justice or like a deer running from a hunter and a hart panting after the water brook. You run and you run for your life and you run because you could defeat Saul. Why couldn't David defeat Saul? He defeated Goliath, didn't he? He took his own hands, didn't he, and killed a bear? He took his own hands and killed a lion? Couldn't David have killed Saul? Well, of course he could. Why didn't he? Because he was too strong. That's why. He restrained himself. And you wait till the one who's trying to kill you is sound asleep, as David found Saul. He looks down and he sees Saul lying there sound asleep, and there's the man who's already thrown a javelin a couple of times at him, and there's the man who's caused him to run like an animal running from a hunter or like a hart running in deer season. And all of a sudden that man is sound asleep and you have your sword and David draws his sword. And you wait till your men say, kill him, master. Kill him, sir. Kill him. You have a right to kill him. He tried to kill you. You have a right to kill him. He's after you. Here's a chance to end it all. And all of a sudden David finds that surge of temptation to take it. Nobody would have tried David or pronounced him guilty in a court of justice. Nobody would have criticized David. The whole country knew what David was trying to do. And David had his sword. And there's his enemy, sound asleep. If you think you ever want to be a man, try that for size. That's what strength is. That's what strength is. Jesus came to make that stronger than killing him. You wait till your own son rebels against you. You wait till your own son gets an army. And you wait till he decides he's going to try to take over your throne. And he declares war on you to take your throne. And not only that, but he goes to your leaders one after the other, as Absalom did, and criticized his dad. And one by one, they became turncoats. And you wait until you flee because you won't fight against your own son. And David flees to a little place called Mahanaim. He'll not fight against his own son. He sees the battle raging back in Jerusalem. He remembers the palace where he once lived, and his son covets it now. He remembers the throne on which he sat that his son is trying to steal. And as he goes, a little fellow named Shimei curses him and throws stones and rocks and dust at him. And David's men say, won't you just take care of this fellow and chop his head off? And David said, no, no. You know what strength is? Strength is not losing your cool. You think strength is showing temper. No, strength is controlling temper. Strength is controlling envy. Strength is restraining covetousness. Strength is saying no to wrong and no to evil. Strength is restraining. Jesus came to make it possible. You wait till your temper boils and your saber temps. All of a sudden you're so mad you can't see anything in front of you but red. All of a sudden you're angry and you say, I've got to fight! I've got to do it! And all of a sudden the flood tides of hatred fill your soul and the flood tides of revenge fill your soul
all of a sudden you say, hold it, I'll control myself. I'll be in charge here. My passions won't control me. My appetites won't control me. I'll decide what I do. I'll be in charge. Self attention and self salutes, and you say self, you do what I say do.
You wait till at college, some little gal comes up to you and tries to lure you to impurity. And she appeals to you, but you restrain yourself and you become a man. Wait till thousands in your army are loyal to you as you general an army, and you call them off. You wait till the happiest hour of your life comes, as was the case in David. David had long wanted to see the Ark of the Covenant come back to Jerusalem. He had planned, prayed, and worked to bring that little piece of furniture back over which rested the Shekinah glory and in which rested sacred things. That little Ark of the Covenant had been gone for some time. Now all of a sudden the Ark comes back home again. And David's the happiest he's ever been because that sacred little piece of furniture is back where it ought to be. As it comes back, David is so happy. He runs out and meets the Ark of the Covenant as it comes down the road. And David runs around the Ark of the Covenant and dances around it, dance of joy, and claps his hands and shouts praises to God. And standing up there looking out the window was Michal. Somebody said Saul tried to get David back. He tried to get it through a javelin. Never worked. So he gave David his daughter, Michal. David married his daughter. And then he wishes, David wished that the javelin had worked. And there's Michal standing up there watching David running around and clapping his hands. The king. And she said, look at the king. Pentecostal. Playing the fool. Acts like he goes to First Baptist. Looks like one of those Hiles Anderson nuts. Yeah, look at him down there. She stands up there with a surly spirit. And David comes home and says, guess what? The Ark of the Covenant's back. God's blessings are back on the people. And she said, aren't you something else? Did you know how you acted down there? There you are, the king. You acted like a little peon. David restrains and exhibits his strength. David controlled himself. David, you're an old man now. You're an old, old man, David. What's the greatest battle you ever fought? You won many a battle. David, was it the time when you took your own hands and killed that lion? Was that the greatest victory that you ever won? The victory over the lion? Or David, was the greatest victory that you ever won the victory over the bear? When you took your own hands and slew that bear, was that the greatest victory you ever won? Or David, was it the mighty victory you won at Ziklag? Was that the greatest victory you ever won? Or David, was it when you took those 5 stones and put one in a slingshot and hurled it toward the temple of the giant Goliath, who was almost 10 feet tall, and you defeated Goliath, and so in so doing, you won the battle over the Philistines, and peace came, and victory came to Israel? Was that the greatest battle you ever won, David? The old man's shoulders aren't as straight as they used to be. Won't be long. Last evening's sun is sinking low. A few more days, and he must go. David's hair is white, and his beard is white. His eyes are filled with crows, circled by crow's feet, and his face is wrinkled, and his brow is furrowed, and David's hands are somewhat palsied. David, tell us before you go to your reward. Tell us, David, what's the greatest victory you ever won? And David pulls at his beard, maybe, and he says, well, I guess maybe. Was that day I won the victory over David when I had a chance to kill Saul and didn't? You mean to tell me, Your Honor, that you consider that a greater victory than when you defeated that lion? Oh, yes. There's something inside me far more dangerous than a lion.
You mean to tell me that you consider that victory over yourself, over your own passions and temptations and desires? You mean that you consider that a greater victory than when you killed the bear with single-handed? Oh, yes, there's something inside me far more deadly than a bear.
Something inside me far more deadly than Goliath also. David said, that's the biggest victory. Or was it the one when Shimei cursed me and threw stones at me when my own son was fighting for my throne? And when they said, won't you chop his head off, take your sword out and kill him? That may have been the greatest victory. I don't know. I don't know. You wait till Jacob returns. And is that your mercy? You wait till that little sissy soup maker who's stolen your birthright and all the treasures and precious things that a birthright entails. And you wait till he takes everything that's holy and right that you wanted, the right to be the priestly leader of the family and be in charge of the family worship, and the right to have a double portion of the inheritance, and the right to carry in your own loins the seed of the Messiah, who someday shall come as King of kings and Lord of lords and rule the world. In one little moment of weakness, Jacob lost all of that. Now Esau lost all of that, and Jacob took it through a little time of tricking Esau. And then when time came for his father to bless him on what they thought was his deathbed, he got the hair of an animal and put it on his neck, because Jacob was smooth skinned. Esau was a hairy fella. And his blind father reached out and he felt the hands and the neck of Jacob and said, that's Esau, okay. And he gave the blessing, his dying blessing, to Esau. Or to Jacob. And Esau was supposed to get it because he was the firstborn of the twins. 20 years Esau had time to let that thing boil in his soul. And finally Jacob says, I've got to go back. Jacob goes back to Esau and Esau meets Jacob. And Esau says, Jacob, all is forgiven. That's what strength is. He who had the power to take his brother's life restrained that passion and controlled himself. You wait till you're mistreated at school. You wait till your child is mistreated at school. And I mean, there is a mistreatment. And since we have most of our teachers are human, we do have some mistreatment. You wait till you're mistreated at school and you know you're mistreated. But you restrain your desire to ruin a teacher. God bless these teachers that work on poverty, for poverty wages, and have to put up with people who can't control their own spirits. You wait till you walk up there and you have the power to call that teacher what you want to call that teacher. And all of a sudden, that passion is coming and surging like a mountain stream. And all of a sudden you stop it and say, hold it, stand still, son of passion. Stop, floods of temptation. I will control myself. Think about that. I think about that man who was on our deacon board. One year he was not on the deacon board for 1 year. We found out that the man, we wanted him to run again for deacon. And then after that, we found out that he had been a deacon the year before and was supposed to run again the next year. But a typographical error in the office had left his name off of the ballot. That man's name was not even on the ballot. And we didn't even find out about it. We tried to get him run again the next year. You know why? Because he exemplified real strength in restraining himself from feeling hurt. And for 1 year was wrongly left off the deacon board. That's what you call strength. Jesus came to change humility from being that of a coward, being that of a hero. He said, you learn to control your own passions. You learn to control your own appetites. You learn to stem the tide and restrain your own desires. He said, that's more powerful and you're more honorable. than a man that can take his saber and lead an army to conquer a city. Anybody can take a strong army and conquer a city with it. God said, you want to be strong? You wait till the passions come. You wait till the temptations come. You wait till the anger comes. You wait till the temper comes. You wait till the chance to be immoral comes. You wait till the chance to be impure comes. You wait till the chance to be indecent comes. And all of a sudden, as it comes like a mighty river, a raging river out of its banks, all of a sudden you stand up and you stop the river and you say, hold it, passion, you will not conquer me. Hold it, temptation, you will not conquer me. Jesus said, that's humility and that's strength. You wait till you're stoned to death as Stephen was outside the city. And Stephen in his dying words looks up to heaven and says, lay not this sin to their charge. You'll know what being a man is. You'll know what character is all about. You'll know what strength is all about. Stephen was killed. He's dying at the hands of wicked men. All he's done is preach Jesus saved. That's all he's done. That's his only crime. They take their wicked hands and hurl stones and kill that fellow. Stephen said, lay not this sin to their charge. It's hard to comprehend, isn't it? Jesus came to make that strength. He came to make that strength. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what humility is. You wait till you're God. And you're wait till you make a race of people who spend most of their time cursing you. You can't get on an airplane without hearing somebody say G-O-D-D-A-M-N. And the breath that fellow breathes is your air. The water he drinks is your water. And the sunshine that brightens his day and causes his day is your sunshine. The food he eats is your food. He profanes you and doesn't even act like you exist and curses you and hates you. Do you ever stop and thank God for his restraint? Do you ever think about that? Do you ever think what it'd be like if God didn't have some restraint? Boy, this whole thing would be in a mess. There wouldn't be anybody alive on this earth but me. You wait till you're God. Just in case anybody here wants to be Christ-like. That's what it is. When he has at his disposal the lightning of the sky and restrains it. Why? Because God is long-suffering and patient. When he has at his disposal the curvature of the earth that he can cause to rumble and rustle and open at any moment, and he does not do it. He restrains himself because he loves a world that hates him and loves men that curse him and profane him. Now listen to me carefully. I'm going to give you a little psychology here. Now follow me carefully, philosophy here. Why is it stronger to restrain than to exhibit? I'll tell you why. Follow me carefully. Nobody is going to give you advice to restrain. If somebody has really done you dirty, you go to your mother and ask her what you ought to do. She'll say, clobber him. You go to your best friends and ask them what you ought to do. You'll say, amen to the clobber. And nobody's going to say, restrain. They're going to say, don't let him run roughshod over you. That's what everybody's going to say. So, when you restrain, him and him, when you restrain, you always stand alone. Did you hear me? When I was a boy, we had a fellow across the street from us named Robert Norman. That's the meanest boy I ever saw. In fact, I hate to say it, he'll get my tape and come and kill me. Oh, I never saw a man born in the internet boy. Robert Norman. Robert, if you get this tape, you're a wonderful fellow now. I love you now. But he was about a year older than I was and about twice my size. Oh, he was mean. Everything I got, he wanted to get it from me. Well, he'd beat up on me. I mean, I was his sparring partner. One day my dad said to me, son, stand up for yourself. That's the advice everybody's going to give you. Stand up for yourself. Stand for your own rights. Dad said, son, don't let him get the best of you. Next time he saw me one day, he said, hey, now I got you. He got off his bicycle. I picked up a 2x4 about that long and threw it at him. Hit him in the back. Man, he got a rock. He came at me. I went in the house hollering, mama, 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 mama. He took that rock and threw it at me inside the house and broke a fruit jar. That's all we had. He broke a fruit jar in that house. My little 100-pound mama beat the daylights out of him. But what I'm saying is my daddy said, get him back, son. Nobody's going to advise you to restrain. That's why when you restrain, you're alone. Nobody advises you. Folks that love you are not going to want you to restrain because, well, what they call love, nobody's going to do that. I don't think I'd even do that to my own kids. I'm saying this. You listen to their advice and you reveal weakness in case you'd like to be a real strong person. You go against the advice of this old world and you take the advice of this old book and you go against every grain there is in life and you withhold your power. And you restrain yourself from doing that which you so want to do. And there's no merit to it if you don't want to do it. I mean, you know, say, a fella says, well, I just never have kissed a woman. Well, you don't deserve any credit for that. You don't want to. Fooey on you. I tell our Howells Anderson guys, we'll ship you home if you don't want to kiss your sweetheart. We'll ship you home if you succeed. You look at those lips. That's preaching, ain't it, fellas? God is moving here tonight. All of a sudden, your lips start acting like a fish. And then those little eyes can get so needy. You look at those little eyes, look at those lips, and look at those eyes. And all of a sudden, boy, the passion comes like a roaring mountain stream. And you say, wait a minute. My mama taught me what to do right now. My preacher taught me what to do right now. Any old punk can go ahead. And all of a sudden you hold your hand up and you restrain. Hold it! Flood tides of passion. Hold it! I'll be quite frank with you. I don't think there's any real merit. And I love sports. I love sports. I really do. My boys got beat today, I heard. So I won't sleep tonight. I'll be crying all night long. It's hard, folks. I love sports. I want to say this. And some of you teenagers that don't listen, I'd like you to wake up for a second and hear what I've got to say. You're not a man because you can hit a ball and crawl over the fence. You have good coordination, but that's not going to make you a man. I've seen girls hit balls over a fence. I've seen girls hit men over a fence. You're not a man because you can lift a dumbbell. You're a dumbbell. Now, I'm not against it. I'm not against weightlifting. I lift a heap of it every time I get up. I'm not. I'm not against weightlifting at all. Nothing wrong with it. But I won't say this, it's not a sign of manhood. And you might be one of these fellows that got all these gristles rippling all over you. I mean, you might, every time you do that, you don't do that because you want to do that. You do that because the muscles here are touching the ones here. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay if you want it. Some of us have it. Ain't nothing wrong with it, but it doesn't make you a man. I mean, you may be the best player on the Chicago Bears defensive line. I mean, the Fridge may be a man, but he's not a man because he's a good football player. Because you can hurl a dead pig across the field when somebody can catch it, doesn't make you a man. Because you can grab somebody and pull him down and roll over on him who has that dead pig. If he drops it, you try to get it. That'd make you a man. What makes you a man? When you restrain your passions, you learn to control yourself and conquer yourself. The other day, I was on a bus. I haven't ridden a bus in a long time. I was on a bus. I mean, I haven't ridden a pay bus, you know what I mean? Yeah. City bus. It wasn't as nice as this amazing city bus company we have in Hammond. Yeah. But it's just, everybody can't go first class like we. Oh, my soul. but anyway, I was on a bus. Now, wait a minute. All of a sudden, several ladies got on the bus and all the seats were taken. Well, first thing I did, of course, because I was taught to do it, I got up and gave one of the ladies my seat. You know, not a single other fellow did that. Not a one. And those ladies kept on standing. You know, being a gentleman is strength. Being courteous is strength. Being proper is strength. Nowadays, at some of our Christian high schools even, the guy that can be rude to the girls, he's the macho man. He's macho ignorant. He's not strong. You know what? It's an inferiority complex that makes him do that. He thinks that's the only way he can get her attention to make him think he's a man. A real man is a gentleman. There's a second reason, and I'll just jump right over it. No, I'm going to touch it on the way. Jesus not only taught us that restraint is more powerful than force, but he also taught us to migrate to better people. The proud man is the man that walks with people and insists that he walks with people below him. He wants to control whatever he is in. He does not want to examine himself or compare himself to strength and superiority. The secret to humility is to be with greater people than yourself. I may take some time to teach about this Wednesday night on the priorities of fellowship. When I was in Japan, I felt like I was Wilt Chamberlain. All those little runts. I walked down the street patting them on the head. Hello, sonny boy. When I shook hands with that Chicago Bear football player this morning, I felt like I needed to straighten my hose. I felt like a sissy. Hello there. But in Japan, What's the difference?
Huh?
A couple hundred pounds. At the right spot. That's the difference. That's the difference. Yeah. The secret to humility is to be a greater people. There's nobody any more ferocious looking than a 12-year-old boy to a 6-year-old boy. But a 17-year-old boy is never bothered by a 12-year-old boy. And the trouble is, most of us are 12 years old, want to run with the 6-year-old so we can be proud. You might better run with the 17-year-old so you can learn something. And that's why we ought to walk with God. And that's why the writer Micah said, "What doth the Lord require of thee?" He said, "Walk humbly with thy God." Jesus came to change it all. He came to change strength from overpowering to yielding. He came to change strength to restraint from exhibition. He came to make strength that of being a gentleman. He came to make strength that of one who could control his own passions. He came to show us that the strongest one was the one who could defeat the greatest enemy, and the greatest enemy is the one that dwells in us. You're your greatest enemy. How you doing on restraint? Controlling yourself? You know you're going to fail on the test. But you know that here's a paper over here that's wide open and she's the smartest girl in the class and you can see the answers, but you won't look. That's when you're a man. That's when you're a man. Some fella in school, maybe he rides the school bus that you ride. And he's a little fella. Maybe he had heart trouble when he was young. Or maybe he has not been well, and so he did not develop physically like you have. And you make fun of him. You're not a man, you're a mouse. Or you taunt him. Like you'd take a stick and scare a bug on a sidewalk. You ever that to a doodlebug? We used to call them doodlebugs. A little kind that roll up in a ball. And I hate to even admit it. I'd get a stick. He'd come at it, and I'd go like that. He'd turn around and go back. I'd put the stick over there. And he'd roll up in a little ball and I'd play marbles with him. That's the way some of you guys treat underprivileged people. We got some folks, for example, I made mention of this at the high school. We got some so-called macho men that can take a stick and knock a ball a long ways. Or can throw a round ball full of air through a hoop. That's how manly they are. Or they can find a fellow running and they can tackle him and make him fall down. That's how manly they are. And they made fun of little Roy Moffat, who's got more genuine guts than all the rest of them put together. You wait till a surgeon's knife is held over your head as you're in the operating room 7 or 8 times the time you're 16 or 17 years old. And you know more about the hospitals than you know about the school you attend. And you wait. And you want to get back, but you smile and you say to your mom and daddy, they don't understand. You're going to find out what being a man is all about. And what being strong is all about. We need some strong, be seated please. We need some strong Christians. Folks behind you want to see. We need some strong Christians. We need some Christians who control their own appetites, their own passions. We need some men who can control themselves. And some ladies who can control themselves. Greater is he that can control his own spirit than he that taketh a city. What doth the Lord require thee? To walk humbly with the Lord thy God. Father,